can only relate.
This attack, mounted by 60 to 70 Japs, was beaten off, and Jemadar Gangabada continued with his digging. A short while later, further probing attacks were mounted by what appeared to be an enemy company on Snowdon East, and also on the east and northeast of Bertie's position on Snowdon West. This attack brought about considerable expenditure of the limited ammunition stocks, so that, between 2100 and 2200 hours, Bertie went round all positions on Snowdon West and gave orders that stones and rocks were to be lobbed along with grenades to the proportion of about 4 stones to 1 grenade in an effort to conserve the latter. Further attacks continued, mainly directed at driving one platoon off Snowdon East, but at the same time keeping Bertie's force on the western feature fully occupied, and, as a result, digging, especially on the isolated platoon position on Snowdon East, was severely affected. Sometime after 0100 hours on 5 March, it became apparent that Jemadar Gangabada's platoon was again being heavily attacked and that they would soon be running out of ammunition. Bertie, therefore, ordered the collection of as many grenades and 303 ammunition rounds as could be safely spared from those section groups on Snowdon West, which had not been so heavily engaged as others. He was in the forward trenches, organising a party to force its way through to Jemadar Gangabada, when, at about 0200, the final determined Jap attack broke on Snowdon East. This attack fell on the sector held by Naik Bombada Tapa's section. The section's forward position came under heavy attack and was in danger of being overrun. Naik Bombada ran under heavy machine gun and grenade fire from his own position and into the threatened post, where he held the enemy attack with his Tommy gun and grenades. He killed 5 Japs to his immediate front and was continuing to hold off the enemy attack when he was wounded by a grenade, which also smashed his Tommy gun. He then ordered a rifleman to bring any reserve grenades he could obtain from platoon headquarters. Before these arrived, the Japs charged the post again. Although severely wounded, Naik Bombada leapt from the trench and met the attack with his kukri, killing 2 Japs and causing the remainder to withdraw. The situation in one platoon's position was now becoming desperate. 8 men had already been killed and 11 wounded. And ammunition of all sorts was finished. Jemadar Gangabada, realizing he could not contain another enemy attack without virtual annihilation, decided to cut his way out of the position and join Major Birtwistle on Snowdon West. Accordingly, he ordered the remnants of his platoon to fix swords and charge the enemy ring. The platoon broke out, carrying their wounded with them, bayoneting their way down the saddle, joining the 2 Snowdons, and finally got through to Snowdon West. The enemy occupied Snowdon East at once and were heard digging in rapidly to improve their previously vacated bunkers and trenches. Having once allowed Snowdon East to fall so easily, the Japs were obviously going to make amends for earlier mistake and hold this feature at all costs. Immediately Jemadar Gangabada's platoon had reached Snowdon West, Major Birtwistle called for the maximum artillery fire on the areas just north and east of the evacuated position on Snowdon East, so as to disrupt the move forward of further Jap reinforcements and to disorganise any enemy plans and preparations for a full-scale attack on the remainder of the Snowdon position. This DF support was promptly given. Without it, the attack on Snowdon West, appreciated by Major Birtwistle, would almost certainly have been mounted. Next, Major Birtwistle considered the possibility of counterattacking the lost position on Snowdon East before first light and before further Jap forces could be brought up or before the reorganising enemy could appreciably strengthen their trenches. But he decided that, with the ammunition state as it was, an attack carried out there and then at night over unreconnoitred ground would be by no means certain to succeed. To mount such a counterattack, at least 2 platoons would have been required. Had the attack failed with heavy casualties, there would have been little chance of holding the rest of Snowdon against almost certain renewed attacks by the enemy, with the small force that would have remained until reinforcements could have been sent forward at first light. Major Birtwistle, therefore, decided to concentrate on holding on to Snowdon West, which he considered at the time to be the vital ground of the feature as a whole. The night passed with sporadic probing attacks continuing on A and D Company's positions from the north and east, but these were obviously weakened by artillery fire support. This fire support, being predicted, was not over-accurate, but was nevertheless a distinct deterrent. With hindsight, many comments were made subsequent to the action on and around the Snowden feature during the night of 4-5 March and on the ultimate outcome, such as the lack of time for reconnaissance of the positions on both Snowden West and East, the accuracy of the available maps was also a hindrance to Major Birtwistle, thus making it impossible for him to appreciate the importance of Snowden East before reaching the area at last light, as last light was approaching. However, no conclusions were reached in the immediate aftermath of the battle, nor later. Two points were clear, however, the first being the shortage of ammunition, since transport carrying reserve stocks could not cross the Mekong until late on 4 March. The second point was lack of time for digging. Had the advance northwards from the Mekong been carried out more swiftly on 4 March, then the CO could have launched A and D companies onto Snowden earlier. Even as little as an extra hour's digging time might have made all the difference to the state of one platoon's trenches by the time the enemy first struck Snowden East. Deeper and better sighted trenches could have prolonged Jemadar Gangabada's hold on the feature until first light, when help could have been effectively rendered from Major Birtwistle's position. Finally, there is the question of the feasibility of an immediate counterattack after one platoon had withdrawn. In my view, it is not practicable to mount a counterattack at night in thick jungle, especially hill jungle, without detailed knowledge of the objective and the approaches to it, gained as a result of thorough daylight recces. To attack blindly at night in such country is begging for serious trouble. Major Birtwistle was right not to mount such a foolhardy venture. At first light on 5 March, Colonel Panton with his R Group passed through my company position at 0.85, en route for Snowden West. Passing through, the CO informed me of the outcome of the night's fighting on Snowden and warned me to be prepared to recapture the lost ground later in the day. I already knew that Snowden East had been lost. My position was only about 700 to 800 yards below Snowden East, and, lying in my command post with my signaller, I had heard the sounds of the night's fierce battle very clearly, and had also listened to Major Birtwistle's periodic sit trips passed by phone to the adjutant, Captain John Gamble, at battalion headquarters located with C Company in the area of the Tumandu Road at Tobacco. Before leaving, Colonel Panton also told me that C Company had been attacked by a small enemy party during the night, which had withdrawn, leaving two dead bodies on the company's perimeter. Later in the morning, at about 0800, the CO called me forward to Snowden West for orders. I set off with my runner, Rifleman Gopi Gurung, and climbed the spur which led from my company's position to A and D Company's location on Snowden West. After about 15 to 20 minutes' climb, I reached Major Birtwistle's headquarters, where I found Colonel Panton waiting for me. The CO then explained to me in detail the events which had taken place during the previous night, after which he took me forward to the north tip of Snowden West, where Lieutenant Bill Woolcombe met us and took us to his forward platoon locality, that of No. 2 Platoon, which overlooked the saddle, joining the two Snowden features. Had I had a bird's eye view of the two Snowdens, I would have seen that they looked like a somewhat uneven, slightly flat-headed horseshoe. The saddle being the head of the shoe, facing slightly west of north, Snowden West being the left side of the shoe, running almost south to north, and Snowden East being the right side of the shoe, slanting somewhat west of north. There were two pimples on Snowden East, one on the northern end and another to its south. It was the northern pimple that Gangabada's one platoon had dug in and where they had fought and lost their battle. This pimple was now held by the Japs. We did not know whether they were on the southern pimple as well. From the northern pimple on Snowden East, the ridge continued slightly west of north through the Jap-held features of Whistle and Strong astride the Tumandu Ann Road. At this time, a thick early morning mist was blanketing the whole Snowden Ridge, with the result that visibility was restricted to almost 20 yards. The CO and I left Bill Walcombe and our runners at platoon headquarters and went and sat on one of the forward section's pits at the head of the saddle leading to Snowdon East. On account of the mist, Colonel Panton was unable to show me the ground ahead or point out any enemy positions on the feature they had seized from Jemadar Gungabada. Through the mist we could hear the clink, clink of picks and shovels striking against the rocks as the Japs on Snowdon East continued to improve their defensive positions. The section commander, in whose locality the CO and I were sitting, informed us that the enemy had been digging continuously since one platoon had vacated the feature. This meant that the enemy had had some 6 hours already in which to strengthen his defences. Colonel Panton went on to remind me of the orders he had given out south of the Mechong 2 days previously, and continued by telling me that B Company would retake Snowdon East regardless of cost. He said that the attack was to start at 14:30, which would allow the mist time to clear and enable the men to have their midday tea and biscuits before moving forward from their present location. The CO was deeply concerned about the state of the men's physique, resulting from the inadequate rations on which they had been fighting and living for such a long time. He felt that by postponing HR until the time mentioned, at least there would be the opportunity for the men to have an additional meal, albeit inadequate, for commencing what was obviously going to be a harsh battle. Colonel Panton ended his orders for the attack on Snowdon East by telling me that, as a result of the shortage of artillery ammunition, I could only be allowed a preliminary bombardment of 2 minutes' duration from one troop of 25-pounders of 8 field regiment and 2 medium guns. I was to take with me the FOO, at present with Major Birtwistle, to direct the fire of the guns, which would be on call and in direct support of my company to deal with opportunity targets which might present themselves during the assault and on capturing the objective. Before leaving the CO to return to my company, I asked if the adjutant could be asked to porter extra hand grenades forward to 0.85, as the battalion's reserves of ammunition had now been brought forward to the north of the Mechong. I thought, incorrectly as it proved, that my company had sufficient ball rounds for the automatic weapons and rifles, but I was anxious to have more than merely 2 grenades per man for the forthcoming attack. I returned down the spur and joined my company again and issued my preliminary orders for the attack on Snowdon East. By the time I had done this, John Gamble had delivered the extra hand grenades to my position. We broke open the boxes and distributed the grenades to bring the scale of issue up to 5 per man. The state of ammunition in B Company was now 100 rounds per rifleman, 25 magazines per Bren, 10 magazines per Tommy gun, and grenades to the scale mentioned. Every platoon and section commander were, in addition, carrying 2 white phosphorus 77 grenades. At about 12:30, after tea and biscuits, I led B Company forward to their assembly area on Snowdon West between A and D Company's positions. I then took my O Group forward to number 2 platoon's locality, and pointed out the platoon positions in the FUP I had chosen earlier in the day, and also the start line, which was just ahead of 2 platoons' forward trenches, at the beginning of the saddle, leading to Snowdon East. Looking ahead towards our objective, we could see very little, despite the fact the mist had now cleared. We could hear the enemy still digging, but could not see any of his positions because of the thick screen of bamboo jungle which was covering the saddle. Above the tips of the bamboo, we could just see the top of Snowdon East, 200 yards away, and that seemed to be covered with less dense primary jungle. From where we were, we could not see how far the bamboo extended along the saddle and up the slopes of our objective. Therefore, despite the fact that there was not much time for recce before HR, I decided that it was vital for me and my O Group to have more detailed knowledge of the enemy's dispositions and the ground ahead than we already possessed as a result of what we could see and from what we had been told. I instructed Haldar Karagbara Tapa, commanding 4 platoon, to call up Knight Tuliale, a most experienced NCO, and his section to carry out a swift recce of Snowdon East. Tuli came forward and I briefed him quickly, telling him to patrol forward with the section and bring me, firstly, topographical information, and secondly, as much detail as he could find out in the time available regarding the enemy's layout of trenches and bunkers on the objective, together with the the positions of his automatic weapons and, if possible, their fixed lines of fire. I told him that he must, at all costs, draw the Japs' fire so as to locate his automatic weapons. Tully then moved off with two scouts ahead of him and the rest of his section spaced out behind him in single file. They advanced down the narrow trail along the top of the saddle and very shortly disappeared from our sight amongst the bamboos. For 10 minutes or so there was silence, apart from the sound of the Japs digging. Then the noise of digging suddenly stopped, and we in the O group looked at one another. The enemy had obviously heard Tully's approach and were standing too. Then a Jap grenade exploded, and then another, and yet another, and then we heard our section replying with rapid rifle and tommy gun and Bren fire. And then, to our relief, we heard the Jap replying with his Taisho and Type 96 LMGs, indicating, we hoped, their positions to Tully's patrol. After about 5 minutes of this exchange of fire, there was silence once more. Some while later, Tully's patrol reappeared, having suffered no casualties. Tully reported that the bamboo extended from our position for about 100 yards on both sides of the saddle and down into the re-entrance to the north and south, but stopped about 100 yards from the top of Snowdon East Ridge. Beyond the bamboo and on the summit of our objective was primary jungle and fairly thick undergrowth, but this only in patches. Fallen trees brought down as a result of last night's shelling presented obstacles between us and the enemy. Knight Tully went on to describe how they had moved off initially in single file, and then, on nearing the far edge of the bamboos, had extended into open formation and crept forward to within about 50 yards of the summit, where they could hear and see the Japs digging. With the bamboos and undergrowth making silent movement difficult, the patrol had eventually been heard by the enemy sentries, who had stood to the main body. Grenades then been tossed on Tully's patrol, who had, as we heard, opened fire in reply, and in order to draw the enemy's fire. This ruse had been successful, and Knight Tully had been able to pinpoint 5 enemy LMG posts. He estimated that Snowdon East was being held by upwards of 2 platoons of enemy, and it appeared that only the northern part of the feature, the part held by Gunga Bada's platoon the night before, was being held. Tully said he had not drawn fire from either Whistle to the northwest or the southern pimple of the objective to the southeast. As a result of Tully's report, I made some additions to my orders for the attack and then assembled my own group. In outline, my plan for the attack was that it would be carried out in one phase by 2 platoons, with the 3rd platoon in reserve with A Company's 2 platoon, to be called forward when required. In detail, No. 4 platoon, Havildar Karakbaratapa, was to be left assault platoon and was to capture the northern part of the objective. On reorganisation, this platoon was to be responsible for holding an arc from the northwest to the east of the objective. No. 5 platoon, Jemadar Chandrabir Thapa, was to be right assault platoon and was to capture the southern part of the objective. On reorganisation, this platoon's responsibility was to hold an arc from the east to the southwest of the objective. No. 6 platoon, Havildar Subakar Thapa, was to remain in reserve on the northern tip of Snowdon West during the assault, and on reorganisation was to move forward to block the gap between the other 2 platoons facing from northwest to southwest and covering back across the saddle towards Snowdon West. During the assault, No. 4 platoon was to move to the left or northwest of the saddle track, and No. 5 platoon was to advance to its right or southeast. Both assault platoons were to keep in touch with one another by advancing with their inner flanks in visual contact along the axis of the saddle track. My company, R Group, was to move behind the assault platoons, whilst company headquarters, under my company 2IC, Subudar Mambara Gurung IOM, remained throughout the assault with A Company on Snowdon West. In addition to the artillery preliminary bombardment and fire support on call that has already been mentioned, both A and C Companies were to assist my attack by direct fire with small arms and 2-inch mortars at opportunity targets on my objective, as and when practicable. The battalion 3-inch mortars had already tried to range on Snowdon East with smoke, but had been unable to clear an intervening spur from the only suitable base plate position that could be found. Communications between the CO at Major Birtwistle's headquarters and me were to be by line. My signallers were to lay line as the assault progressed, and, as and when necessary, my phone was to be attached to the line for the passage of information from front to rear. Radio communications, on account of unreliability, were not to be used for this attack. The plan was simple and straightforward, but it now remained to be seen whether or not the enemy on Snowdon East would allow it to work. At the end of my orders, my platoon commanders left me to brief their platoons. It was at this stage, as far as I can remember, that my artillery FOO, who had been with Major Birtwistle the night before, said that he was not anxious to accompany my R group during the assault, as he had had enough close contact with the enemy during the past 24 hours. I realized that a frightened man would be of no value to me during the coming afternoon, so I agreed to his remaining in A Company's position, from where he assured me he could give me adequate support. As a result of my decision then, I must be held entirely responsible for the casualties caused in my company, later on by inaccurate artillery fire support. With more experience, my correct action should have been to take this craven subaltern to the CO and ask Philip Panton to arrange for another FOO to come as replacement. However, I did not do this. By 14:15, the orders to and briefing of the platoons were finished, and the sections of the assault platoon started moving forward to their positions in the FUP. The sun was beating down through the trees, and we were starting to become very thirsty. Rumours had been prevalent recently that the 25th Division would be coming out of the line shortly for a period of rest and refitting. We did not know at this time that this move would be to train for Operation Zipper, the assault landing on the Malayan Peninsula. Amongst the 1,001 thoughts that run through an infantryman's mind as he waits and prepares himself to cross the start line, glancing so frequently at the minute hand of his watch as it moves towards HR, there were many of us I know in B Company on that hot afternoon who wondered, in addition, if this in fact was to be our last attack, and which of us would stay behind for all time on the hill that rose ahead of us. At 14:28, the troop of 25-pounders and two medium guns boomed out from Gun Island, the gun position area to our rear, and the shells whistled and whined over our heads to burst on the Jap positions on Snowdon East. For a moment we forgot our own thoughts as we watched the shells bursting in and shattering the big trees ahead. And then the bombardment ceased as suddenly as it had begun. It was HR. At 14:30, both assault platoons fixed swords and crossed the start line at the head of the saddle, which led to Snowdon East. 3 hours is not a very long time, relatively speaking. The Battle of Snowdon East lasted exactly 3 hours. But the afternoon of 5 March 1945 was the longest afternoon of my life. I thought it would never end. Despite the fact that the battle seemed at the time to be interminable, I could remember when it finished only very few salient features of it, which remained and will always remain imprinted vividly in my mind. The passage of nearly 50 years has not aided my memory, and what I say now in order to try and to describe the fighting on Snowdon East, particularly individual soldiers' actions, may well be out of sequence, but as this story will, unfortunately, never be heard by those brave men to whom it is intended to be a tribute. Such errors that exist will, I hope, be of small account. After crossing the start line, all was quiet, apart from the crackling of the bamboos as 4 and 5 platoons wove their way through the thick cover on either side of the saddle. No sound of supporting artillery fire broke the silence and gave that extra fillip to morale that the noise of one's own guns always gives at this stage of an attack. The safety factor prevented any such support being given once the leading sections had started moving along the saddle. No sound came either from the Japs dug in on Snowdon East. I wondered what effect, if any, our brief bombardment had had on them. The assault platoons continued to filter through the bamboo thickets and on towards the objective. One or two shells had fallen short and burst amongst the thickets, splintering the bamboos and making progress awkward. Then the leading sections came out of the bamboo and found themselves in the primary jungle beyond, and it was here that we first saw and felt the effects of the artillery bombardment. The trees had been splintered and shattered, and many had been felled in a criss-cross fashion, forming an obstacle between us and our objective that no Jap wire-laying party could have equaled had they worked and toiled for days. On the right flank, in the path of 5 Platoon, the dry jungle had also started to burn. It was whilst the assault platoons were struggling through this tangled barrier of broken trees that the Jap first hit us. They hit us hard with every weapon they possessed, the range of about 75 yards. And then, as they had done during the fighting on Pun, they rolled grenades strapped to their Hakkabakkarai mines down upon us as the leading sections climbed upward through the splintered trees. The leading soldiers started to fall, toppling over in the scrub like shot rabbits, but so far the assault had not faltered. Individuals in sections were pausing to take cover and fire up the steep slope towards the enemy, and were slowly but surely pressing on, leapfrogging groups up the hill by fire and movement. And then they hit us again. This time it was from the left flank, from Whistle, 200 yards away, where the Japs had a rifle company dug in. From Whistle, they opened fire along fixed lines with two Juki MMGs. The stream of bullets from these guns came at hip height, mowing like scythes through the corn, through the bamboo, fallen timber, and the ranks of 4 Platoon and the left flank of 5 Platoon. As the Jap fire commenced from our left flank, so it intensified from our front, from the enemy dug in above us. With numbers of soldiers going down and the curtain of fire thickening and preventing all free movement, we began to waver and then finally halted. Cover was sought wherever it could be found, and the long firefight, which was to use up so much of our precious ammunition, started between us and the enemy on the objective. Lying on the ground, amongst the tangled barrier of trees, was relatively safe, but casualties mounted slowly from the grenades and mines rolled down from above. To move either forwards or backwards was to get hit by the aimed fire from Snowdon East or from the MMGs firing on fixed lines from Whistle. Those guns on Whistle seemed to have unlimited stocks of ammunition, as they never ceased firing until right at the very end of the battle. Apart from the dead, our most serious wounded casualties were being caused by the Hakkabakkarai mines, as, on bursting on or near a man, they had a most shattering effect on the part of the body which was hit. Probably 60% of our total casualties received in this battle were caused by these mines and the MMGs fired from Whistle. It was clear to me that the momentum of our attack had faded and that it was in danger of rapidly becoming bogged down. Lying at the edge of the saddle track, I kept wondering whether our inertia was wholly due to the enemy's fire or whether there was something more than that behind it. I wondered then, and I wonder still, whether the rumours we had heard about the division coming out of the line were having a subconscious effect on our actions. No one in his right mind wishes to take risks that might bring about his death or permanent injury. Sometimes, in the heat of battle, many soldiers give such risks little or no thought, and the result of their actions often have far-reaching effects. Here we were, however, in the heat of battle, content, if that's the word,